And welcome to this podcast from the Business Marketing Club, or BMC. My name's Dave Stevens. I'm a B2B marketer and I'm chair and co-founder of the BMC. The Business Marketing Club is a not-for-profit community network of B2B marketing professionals and people interested in B2B marketing. It's run by business marketers for business marketers, and we provide face-to-face and virtual event meetups, training, podcasts, blogs, newsletters, mentoring, social media groups, community groups, and gatherings for business marketers. Today, we've got over 1,000 participants across the world. If this is the first time you've joined us, you're very welcome. Check us out at businessmarketingclub.org.uk. But if you've been with us before, well, welcome back. It's really good to have you along again. In this episode, I'll be speaking to strategic marketer Alex Brayshaw to look at some new marketing technologies. Plus, TechFuse's Adam Trainers talks about brand differentiation. The head of online at PwC, Nick Masters, shares a key lesson that he's taken on his marketing journey. And director at Sales Process Engineering, Patrick Ray, celebrates some great business marketing. While the consumer world has embraced influencers across most sectors and channels, B2B has struggled to do so, not for lacking in influencers, of course, but maybe something else. What is holding us back? I'm joined by strategic marketer Alex Brayshaw to try and answer that question and give some tips on how to go about it. Alex, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Dave. Great to be here as always.
It's great to have you. So first of all, tell us a little bit about your background as a strategic marketer.
Absolutely. I've spent the last 25 years working with lots of great brands, big brands, small brands, interesting kind of tech businesses, all areas of B2B, and just helping with delivering creative, strategically led marketing campaigns. And I love it.
Well, in that case, we're both in the right place. That's good news. So let's talk about these influencers then. And we kind of started out by saying that the B2B world isn't lacking for influencers. And maybe we should just test that before we get started. How do you identify influencers in our sector?
Indeed. And I think one of the issues here, and I was kind of in two minds as to how to talk about this, but I think the term influencer marketing, influencers, sometimes is a little bit misunderstood. And I think that's probably because of what happens in the consumer world. But I think in many ways, think of it as partnerships. And as you start to think about partnerships, it actually starts to feel a little bit easier to get your head around. But in terms of identifying people, I guess there's a couple of key kind of obvious places to look. And one's obviously externally from the organization that you work in, and one's internally. So I guess let's start the external piece. Obviously, this isn't about finding some celebrities in B2B, although there's obviously plenty, to kind of tout our products and services through Instagram. It's we're obviously much more civilized in B2B. And it's a pretty sophisticated approach in terms of how you develop influencer relationships. And that's really what it's about. It's about like-minded partnerships that kind of come together to create content and discussion, maybe take part in events, and with a sort of a joint goal of driving growth and awareness. And I guess in a joined up, very transparent way to help people make decisions about some of those services and kind of look to people to get some views on those kind of things. So if you think about all of that, if you look at external influencers, go back to the basics. Who are our customers? Who's the audience? Where do they hang out? What content do they engage with? You know, whether it's ours or whether it's competitors, and kind of what kind of information and people are they talking to? And that could be people within the sector of the industry you're working in, people that are being listened to, the trusted voices. And I think the place to go to start with that, obviously, talk to the sales guys, talk to the account management teams, because they're kind of talking to your audience all the time. So they can be asking, you know, who are you listening to? Who are your peers that you kind of really look up to? But you can also talk to media partners and media agencies. They've got all sorts of data, and actually a much stronger kind of sets of data in B2B than we used to have years ago. And then there's technology. So yes, we can kind of talk to lots of people, do some kind of research on your own, but there's lots of technology. I mean, I've used things like Brandwatch and Analytica, which are social platforms, and they give you, of course, lots of listening data, but they also give you influencer kind of data as well. So you can kind of look at somebody and go, okay, what's their presence in the market? What's the kind of content that they're producing or reacting with? Who are they connected with? Even LinkedIn, you can kind of do a lot of that work with LinkedIn as well in terms of the networks they're part of and how well, how they perceive to be an influencer. And I think it differs quite a lot to B2C in the sense that we're not chasing volume. We're not saying who's got 2 million followers. It's about quality. It's about the quality of that kind of set they're part of. So the kind of rules of B2B and our highly targeted nature apply. And then for all those kind of quite specific things, you then want to look at, okay, does this person align with our brand values? Is there a kind of common interest? They kind of talk and care about the same things as us. So that's kind of how I go about identifying it. And actually, chances are, when you think about all of that and think about it as a partnership, chances are you've probably got relationships with lots of the right people already. And it's just about, well, how do we activate them? How do we kind of build a kind of more structured kind of way of working together?
But you're already, from what you said there, there's quite a scale to this. You know, there's a huge amount of potential. So I wonder if you can help size it for us. How big a part of the marketing mix should this be?
Well, it's a lot of the people I talk to and the research that I look at is suggesting it's becoming an even greater mix. I think there's studies I've seen that sort of saying, you know, 70-80% of kind of B2B CMOs are absolutely putting more budget into influencer marketing. And I guess that means it has to be a greater part of the mix. If it is used as a tactical kind of piece within the mix, you're not really going to get much benefit. This has to be integrated. It has to be something that feeds, is connected to the rest of the things you're doing. It has to be, and actually there's lots of people I talk to who don't even mention it as a kind of program. And I think that's because we're still probably in our infancy and kind of how it works, and also who owns it. I think that's part of the issue is people go, well, is it a PR team? Is it social team? Is it marketing? Is it sales? Who owns it? And actually, in reality, it sits across everything. It should be connected to all of those things. And it connects to our demand programs. It connects to everything else we do. So I think it should sit across the whole piece, and it's growing. And I think there's continued investment going into it.
So there's clearly plenty of upside. It's got me wondering, though, whether there's also an equivalent downside. What are the things that we need to be wary of?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, it's definitely not all positive. There's definitely things we need to think about and also consider the right kind of influencers you want to work with. And I think it's about putting the effort in up front because you want to get it right. This is a long-term relationship. So you don't just want to sort of jump in with somebody having not done the due diligence. So I think find the right people, but spend time working out what you want to do together, what you kind of want to achieve together, what's in it for both parties. Get a strategy right. Do you want them to help with content? Is it about events? What's the actual contribution going to be? And be wary of just dipping in and out of these relationships. Think about it as a long-term program. I think, as we touched on earlier, don't keep it as a silo. Think about program across all of the mix. Involve the right people from different parts of the organization. And don't under-resource it. Don't just let it sit with somebody to sort. Ensure people are kind of bought into it. And actually think about how you might validate all of those suggestions of influencers you'll get. So if someone says, oh, I've got a mate who'd be a great influencer, I think I know they're pretty good at this stuff, still go through the validation process. Use the technology we talked about. Make sure they have got the right kind of audience and reach that you think you need.
So we've been talking sort of fairly theoretically, I guess, till now. So let's make it a bit practical. Who's doing this well? Who's leading the way?
I think there are a number of organisations. I think you can look at, and who've done things very, very differently. So Adobe, SAP, Dell, LinkedIn have actually run some really interesting programs as well to sort of build out influencers. And I think if I took SAP as a good example, they've been doing influencer marketing probably 7, 8 years, maybe a bit more actually. And I think they've been doing it in all sorts of guises, from events to content. And I think they have a really smart model in terms of, and I don't work with them, so I kind of don't know the ins and outs, but I see lots of how the work they do. And they do build long-term relationships that seem to be mutually beneficial. They've got a podcast series that they run. Even we're on podcasts, we know they're good. But there's a great podcast series that includes lots of interesting kind of partners they work with. I think some are even customers. But you can see that they're long-term developed relationships that give a really even kind of view about different topics. And I think SAP, particularly for me, are doing some really interesting stuff. I think the LinkedIn piece is great because they're coming at it from a quite a different perspective. Because obviously, I think they have, if they can demonstrate influencer marketing well, they've obviously got a benefit off the back of it as well, because they can sell some really interesting kind of data around it. But they did some really interesting campaigns where they brought together various influencers using the intelligence they have to identify groups of influencers and kind of putting together some interesting content around that.
Some great examples there. Alex Brayshaw, thank you very much.
For years, marketers have been told to differentiate their businesses or face doom. Then along came Byron Sharp, who argued that it was distinctiveness, not differentiation, that mattered. To help us navigate the debate, I'm joined by Adam Trainis of TechFuse. Adam, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Dave. Thanks for having me here. It's great to join you today.
It's good to have you here. So, first of all, before we get started, tell us a bit about TechFuse.
Okay, TechFuse is a very newly formed marketing agency. It's an agency that specializes in servicing B2B customers, and principally B2B customers in the fintech and payment space. I set it up very recently with an ex-colleague, and the idea is that we kind of blend our services really and blend our experience. So my background is very much client side and hers is agency side, and we want to bring the benefits of that to the market.
Okay, and so that means I think you're in a pretty good place to be able to talk to us about the conflict between differentiation and distinctiveness. Maybe first of all, you can define for us the difference between differentiation and distinctiveness when it comes to branding.
Of course, thank you. So when I think of differentiation or brand differentiation, I think that primarily being based on the USPs of a brand. Differentiation comes from, was based on the strategic decisions to develop elements of a brand proposition or a value proposition that separate you from your competitors. This could be the breadth of the offering, speed of technical integration, or having a unique business model. There's numerous ways to differentiate. Crucially, though, and this is the sort of the main point really, is your point of differentiation should be a significant value to your customers and perceived as differentiating you from your competitors. Distinctiveness, however, is being recognized by your customers as you and you only, typically by developing a suite of assets that are recognized as your brands and your brands alone, you achieve that distinctive position. True distinctiveness is the harmony really of getting those factors together where the customer recognizes you and they recognize that those assets are yours. When we consider distinctiveness, obviously attribution is key. It's all about attribution. Thinking back on my experience, recognition really is only the first step, having conducted lots of brand studies or brand re awareness research in the past. Misattribution actually of assets is very common, which to me goes to show that actually achieving distinctiveness and attribution is actually quite a tricky thing to do.
Okay, so let's put you on the spot. Which of those is actually the most important when it comes to branding, and why?
Good question. So if we go back to Byron Sharp's premise, his idea is really that distinctiveness or distinctive branding lasts, and it provides a long-term competitive advantage, whereas differentiation can provide some level of competitive advantage, but it's harder to achieve long-term. He also argues, and from his point, that differentiation actually matters very little to a customer, and it's more about the idea that you're solving their problem. Does your product or service solve their problem within their whatever constraints they have in terms of resources, whether that's time, technical capability, or price, actually. So you being different from a customer actually matters very little. And to some extent, I would agree with that. And I think what you're looking for as a marketer is to balance the two, really, is to have a proposition that is different, but ultimately is based on solving the pain points of your customer. So it comes back really to knowing your customers. Your starting point should always be know your customers. And in reality, I think true differentiation really only comes from innovation. Because when I was thinking about ahead of this recording, I was thinking of how many products and services have I used in the past that I've looked for a point that are really, really different from the competitive offering. And actually, it's probably very few.
Yeah.
And, you know, was in a B2B setting where you're looking for more, kind of more specifics, basically, than, or your criteria is potentially tighter than in a B2C setting. Actually, does it really matter? Is that part of the RFP? Probably not. And being distinctive, I think, is an ideal scenario. And ultimately, what you're looking to do there is have those assets create or take away a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of your marketing. You know, that they give you standout, they create a mental shortcut for your customers. Therefore, your marketing dollar, your marketing spend goes that much further. And you think of the biggest brands, they've spent lots of money and lots of time and lots of effort creating those assets, and they're the ones you remember. And I think that's where it becomes a challenge, actually, particularly for newer or early lifecycle brands, is that you can create assets that are distinctive. However, in the minds of your customers, actually achieving that takes time and it takes spend, in my experience, I think. So, yeah.
Sorry to interrupt you. So how about if you kind of overlay this with measurement? Can you, yes. You know, is there a way of how would you go about measuring differentiation, and how would you go about measuring distinctiveness?
Good, great question. And everything should be measured. So I think, like any other kind of strategy or tactic, you're looking to drive value in the business. And if either of those tactics or strategies, whatever you want to call them, aren't moving the needle on your KPIs, then you should probably think differently or think about doing something different, because both will take up resources, whether that's time or spend. They come back to really knowing your customer. So, being distinctive is... being distinctive, for example, a measurement could be, you know, one is undertaking research, but also it should be able to help your sales team. You know, being a brand that when your sales team go out and talk to potential customers, when they're prospecting, etc., familiarity is something that should help them a long way. Obviously, if you're a newer brand, that's much more difficult to achieve. And I think so. I mean, outside of kind of research, I think they are quite difficult to measure, because I think when you think of points of difference, that should be initially based on really understanding your customer anyway. So you should know your customer and build the points of difference that solve their pain points. So I think that's the way I would go about that. And then distinctiveness, you can measure that through research and studies. And and what you would be looking to do is create, you know, look at that over time, like with any marketing, particularly awareness or brand-based marketing. Actually, what you're looking for is trend, and that the trend is moving in the right direction, really. So there's more of your prospective audience who recognize you and then would see you and consider you as kind of a go-to brand or have significant mind share. Yeah.
Okay. I think you you touched a little bit on this next question already, but if we put a kind of practical lens on this, which businesses do distinctiveness and which businesses do differentiation well?
Okay, yeah, this is a good question. And I think it's kind of, well, there's a few that I think. So if I think about differentiation, I think who is truly kind of out there doing something different. And one of the brands, albeit a sort of a major brand, actually is someone like LinkedIn. So they provide a product that, I'm sure there are similar products in the market, but they are primarily providing a service that pretty much isn't available elsewhere. And there's nothing really that competes with that. And they've kind of evolved over time in terms of how they've been offered for a while. It was very much a kind of home for recruiters, really. And then it's morphed into something much, much more useful in terms of providing an information base for anyone in business, really. A couple of other good examples, I think Slack, as a tool. I mean, they're doing incredibly well at the moment. Launched as the email killer, but actually that, is a great kind of platform for businesses to kind of communicate. And it is a point of difference. It genuinely is a point of difference. And then I was thinking about another brand that kind of took a slightly different approach, and that's Stripe. So Stripe, I'm not sure you're familiar with them. They're a payments platform. And what they did actually as a point of difference, and I think this was a smart move, is they looked at the audience, and their audience, rather than being a kind of, I suppose, the finance team in the business, actually they switched to developers, and they focused on creating a very, very simple, very quick integration that was developer light, and all of their marketing, everything was focused on that audience. So they really pivoted away from what was available in the market at the time, and thought about differentiation differently. I think that's right. So rather than just saying, okay, we've got a different product here, actually really understanding their customer base and thinking, who is it here? Is it the finance team? Well, yes, it is. But actually the primary buyers and the primary influencers here, it could be the developers, and actually they've gone, they're a huge business now off the back of that, really. So offering something that's kind of super simple. And then in terms of distinctiveness, lots of kind of big brands, Salesforce, IBM, Chimp, they're kind of big B2B brands that have visual assets, I think, that do stand out and would be very easily recognized by the majority of the market. Another brand I thought of actually, who took a slightly different approach, was Intel, in so much that they'd created a sonic, or a kind of, a sound logo, as it were, that they'd run with for years. And I challenge most people who haven't heard it more than a couple of times to think that they didn't recognize it and couldn't attribute it, actually. I think, they've done such a good job with that. And I know that, I think it was probably 2 years ago, MasterCard actually launched their own sonic. Now, I probably heard it at the time, but it certainly hasn't landed in the same way that, Intel and some of the kind of B2C brands have done that. Yeah. But I actually thought that was quite a nice and a sort of a different way of approaching assets, because they're typically thought of, aren't they, as the visual asset, the logo, the lockup, etc., and even the brand or the colour, the sort of brand colours or the colourways that you use, really. So, yeah, some big brands there, but I think, they're the ones that, particularly on the distinctive asset side, they've probably had the budget and the time to really land those.
Adam Trainis at TechFuse, thank you very much.
Thank you, David. Thanks very much.
Next up, Nick Masters shares a key lesson that he's taken on his career journey to being head of growth and digital at PwC. Nick, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Dave. Good to meet you again.
Good to see you. So tell us, first of all, what's top of mind at PwC right now?
Oh, I'm sure we're very similar to everyone else. Our primary concern is what's affecting our clients, right across industry. And also, how are we going to ensure our people reintegrate back into the new world in whatever form that is, and can do the best that they can to make sure that we as a business fit back into a sort of way of working in next year that's going to be critical for whole of the UK and the UK economy. Now, it's not putting us at the centre of the entire UK economy, but it's something that, you know, we're trying to work across as many different angles as we can, because the kind of imperatives of making sure that not only businesses are supported, but those things like getting people into shops and offices and things like that are critical. So, you know, we're juggling the same kinds of challenges, I think, that most businesses are at the moment.
Every time I touch base with you, Nick, you have a slightly longer job title than the last time. So as Head of Growth and Digital, I'm kind of interested in what skills and experiences you would say were kind of important on your journey to getting to become Head of Growth and Digital at PwC.
Right. I think the short answer to that, although that it happened quite a long time ago, was that my first career was in journalism and publishing, and that taught me a huge amount in a relatively short space of time in terms of how the world works and how things all fit together, and also how the imperative of making sure that people pay attention to you. Because that's something I think that a lot of organisations take for granted. They assume that people care about them. In the publishing world, you don't and you can't. I became, I suppose, not exactly disillusioned, but I really wanted to do the things that I was talking about. You know, it was great commenting and covering other people. There was a sense of, I wonder if I could actually do any of these things. So, you know, the driver for me was to bring that sense of the outreach that comes from publishing and the communications aspects of that and the information aspects of it, but I'd combine it with the reality of working in, you know, a business environment. And that's really what I've been doing ever since, is to try and merge those two things. I think that working within any kind of business or corporate environment for exclusively, you know, in one organization or one industry or one sort of style, if you like, is limiting, because you're going to have a very sort of a narrowish worldview. And I think I've been able to bring that, you know, the perspective of how do you ensure that people pay attention to what you're doing, but also that's constant striving to do something a little bit different. It's, you know, that is the world of publishing. Nobody in publishing has any money. All they have are their own ideas and their own resources, and that's what you have to live off. And I think that's been the you know, one of the things that's helped me continue even to this grand old age to continue to, you know, to hopefully do new things.
And I wonder if digital is quite important to that. You know, is it digital that is the thing that has enabled you to connect the outreach, the networking, the kind of innovation that you talk about, and to bring those different things together?
Absolutely. It was kind of written, I suppose, because I was working in magazines and then in newspaper, working in Asia in magazines and then in London on the Evening Standard, and in the mid late 90s, and you're looking at this world and you're thinking, if I saw, you know, in a magazine sense, if I saw something a month after I'd written it, I was thinking, wow, this is pretty good. Even in the Evening Standard, if I saw something even the same day as I'd written it, it was amazing. You know? But largely it was the next day. And suddenly you're publishing this stuff, what, now? And see if somebody can read it then. Absolutely. It was an absolutely driven decision, because it was like, that's the world I want to be in. That's completely the world I understand. I'm easily bored, you know, the ideas of going to the same thing, you know, the same trade shows, the same meetings every 6 months or whatever else. It just didn't appeal, you know, the constant sense that you could do something different was an absolute, you know, dream for me. So I know lots of other people don't agree, and I know it is strange and disturbing, and it can have unintended consequences. But is that sort of that slight sense that there's always going to be something coming around the corner at you that you kind of have to learn and have to get your head around, and that sort of sense of renewal has been a critical part for me of all of this.
What about for people who are starting out on this digital journey now? So for people who kind of look at your job title and kind of aspire towards going on that direction, is there anything that you any kind of place that you'd urge them to start in terms of beginning to build up the skills that they need to get into a place at working in digital at an organization like PwC?
If anything, I'd say no, in as much as my experience, I think, is not atypical of a good background to have, because the broader that experience and the different environments in which you have had to work through problems will stand you in good stead. So, when I was working, the place that I worked before here was a startup company with four of us in an office. I now work for an organization, and I moved to, with 250,000 people globally. The experiences that you have there when you are literally living hand to mouth and doing everything yourself are so completely at odds, with this other world. But one inspires the other, and you can learn an awful lot, because the motivation and the sense of satisfaction you get when you've done something that you can point out the whole thing beginning to end, that's mine, or that's ours, this us here on a Friday afternoon, we did that this week. Obviously it's very different in a big environment, and I think if you haven't got that mix, if you haven't seen the world from both of those perspectives, you might be missing a little bit, that sort of slight sense of, somebody else looks after that. The drive to make sure that, you get things done, is there. So I think there's very little that's bad experience in that respect. I don't think it's a good thing for people only to work in large corporate environments or anything like that. I think it's that sense of achievement and motivation that you get from working, into both, as I said earlier, working abroad as well was critical. All things that I think, I hope, have added to that sense of where I am now. And I wouldn't put anyone in a position where there's a kind of a path. I think that's definitely not something you would need to be kind of constricted by.
Nick Masters, Head of Growth and Digital at PwC. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
There's some great B2B marketing out there, and I'm joined now by Director of Salesprocess.co.uk, Patrick Ray, to talk about it. Patrick, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for asking me.
It's good to have you here. So before we get started with some great B2B, tell us a bit about Salesprocess.co.uk.
Okay, well, we specialize in the alignment of sales and marketing systems and processes and people. So this started really about 15 years ago when there was a very distinct need. I mean, one of the biggest problems we address as a consultancy in this area in the B2B field is when sales and marketing teams just frankly don't talk. They certainly don't work together. Yeah. And increasingly we found that when we were brought in to deal with a problem, that was a sort of fundamental issue. And from that, we developed the sales process system, which aligns sales and marketing with the research market need and the buying process. So we do a lot of work, for example, with companies that sell to top 100 companies, IT systems and other sorts of services. And we work with them to look to see how a need emerges and arises in a top 100 company and other companies too. Where in the organization, who owns the problem, who's influenced and affected by that particular problem, and then how the need emerges into a specific request for a proposal.
Okay.
And we build a plan and a map around that. And then from that, we can specify the full sales and marketing process, from generating initial awareness, generating leads and inquiries, MQLs, to SQLs and then through the whole sales spectrum too, through to the close.
Got it. Okay. So, and that means then that in your travails, you'll have seen many a bit of great business to business marketing, I suspect. So what's caught your eye?
Okay, there's frankly a lot of sameness in marketing. I mean, I know you have a lot of interesting people on doing a lot of different things, but for me, someone with frankly a lot of experience, to try and find something new or something, some way in which we can improve upon what we're doing, with all due modesty, it is difficult. I have to say, of what I see, I particularly like what HubSpot does. I mean, it's incredibly professional. It's a cracking system, and I bear no particular interest in the HubSpot organization. We do integration of HubSpot, but we do have other CRM systems too. But what is very clever is they really draw you in because of the sheer value of all the information that they hold. And a lot of it is to do with sales process, which is very much our area. So it's about account-based marketing, sales process, about personas and all those good things. So I would advise anyone listening to this, really, if they've got any particular interest in any given topic of marketing, to have a look at that. But over and above that, I like to look around the subject matter of marketing. For example, looking at I'm very interested in sales, again, because of the alignment with marketing. So I look at a lot of sales sites. And, I mean, hopefully this is relevant for the listeners today too. Sales such as websites such as podcasts such as Sales Hacker, Max Altshuler. I mean, we could share these links perhaps separately. Does some great stuff. And there's a big overlap between the sort of the good quality sales information and sales blogs, because one could incorporate that within communication, marketing communications, but also again within an aligned sales and marketing process. It is all part of that process. So good marketing people need to know about good sales systems and processes and applications. So that's one area I'm also interested.
Come in there. So in the examples that you've given there, you're talking about a kind of depth and richness of content. But is it something more than that as well? I mean, if you look at HubSpot, for example, is there something about the way that they make their content accessible to you that impresses?
Absolutely. It's just completely non-selling. And I put that in quotes because, of course, they are and they know we are. And you and I as professional marketing people know they are. But it's just very accessible. In fact, it's like a library, the way that it's construed. And it's extremely well organized in terms of SEO. If you type in on persona or ABM or any of the sort of main marketing topics, invariably you'll find HubSpot right at the top. And again, when you go in instantly, there's good accessible information, there's very little attempt to sell, and it's quality stuff. So I think there's a big lesson for us as marketing people in that the more you engage with the people, the more you draw them in. And I've found myself recommending the HubSpot system. And it's one of the ones that we use too, again, with other CRM systems. But it's got me talking about it, and that's what's so clever about it.
Has. And does that apply to some of those sales podcasts that you reference?
Very much so. I mean, the Sales Hacker, Max Altshuler, he's the guy that does Sales Hacker, very much too. You go on there, and they've got some cracking tips about things like approaching C-level prospects too, about use of email, about sort of following up in sales. Good, again, it's like a cracking library, and that's probably a template for good content. It should be like a library, the information that you hold, and it's good old marketing stuff. Building yourself, your organization as an authority in the field, showing that it's a repository of expertise in the particular area. And that's how you build the brand in simple terms, isn't it?
And would you say that you have taken that approach and you've applied it to the work that you do at salesprocess.co.uk?
Absolutely, increasingly so, more and more. So we do a lot that, in fact, I'm a CIM course director, so I do training on behalf of the our Chartered Institute of Marketing. So a lot of what we do in consultancy is training, and it's as much almost as much training as consultancy. So we run workshops where we go and we work with the, and this is a sort of very much what we do, is a workshop with the sales and the marketing team in a room for a day, and we go through with them. So we capture their expertise, their experience. We're facilitators, but also too, because of the sorts of experience that we bring from different fields. We do a lot in the IT field, building, construction, security, those sorts of areas. So it's aligning, well, it's all about alignment. Again, it's sales and marketing alignment, but it's aligning too with best practice in the marketing industry.
Patrick Ray, Director of Salesprocess.co.uk. Thank you very much. And that's it. That's all for this episode of the Business Marketing Club podcast. Thanks to my guests, Alex Brayshaw, Adam Trainis, Nick Masters and Patrick Ray. And thanks to our technical team from Through the Eye of Scott Jackson, Andrew Gratian, Alex Horn and Josh Bench. Most of all, though, thanks to you for listening. Do rate or review us if you can, and email me at davestevensnow@gmail.com if you'd like to be a speaker or offer feedback. I hope to see you again. Thanks for listening.